Good to have you all here. We are going to be concluding today the end of Hebrews 11, and I hope you've been enjoying this. It's just a great passage of scripture where it's kind of this recounting of all the heroes, all the people that lived by faith that inspire us in such a way to live our lives as they did. And in our passage today, it uses this phrase that they lived in a manner that the world was not worthy of. And I love that expression in the sense of this transcendence, that to live a life of faith is to somehow get above it all. I was thinking this week, I had a conversation with my daughter, and there was a bit of an offense that was given to my sweet little girl. And I was saying, hey, you know what? The view always looks better from the high road. And in some ways, that's what we're talking about here, how to live on this high road and this transcendent reality where you're not getting sucked into all the muck and the mire of this kind of the darkness, the stuff that we so often are navigating our way through that just has this way of sticking to us. How do we live above that? How do we transcend all of that? And I think this whole passage is about this vision to live our life by faith, living in light of a greater perspective. And this idea of heroes, I was thinking, you know, the last song that Philly just sang, this idea of God doing something beautiful out of us. And I think some ways it's easier to say beauty than to say heroic. Let me ask you this. How many of you want to be a hero? All right. Like three of you. So do this, just a little thought experiment. Now picture yourself like 10 years old. How many of you want to be a hero? Right? Like you do, but you somehow learned along the way. No, not me. When I was a kid, I wanted to be Han Solo so bad. I loved that line. C-3PO says, sir, the likelihood of surviving an asteroid field is 3,720 to 1. And Han Solo says, never tell me the odds. And I was like, that's who I want to be, right? Like that guy, like that heroic, like calm in the face of danger. How do you become that? And in some ways, this is what it's trying to stir in us. To be inspired, like, yeah, despite the odds, like, bring it. How do we live our life in such a way? These are the people that live by faith. And at the end of our chapter, you get the sense that our author has run out of room. He's been telling us these stories. He's talking about creation, and then he's talking about Enoch. He's talking about all these different people, Moses and Abraham, and then all of a sudden he just goes, and then a bunch of other people, right? Well, here, let me read our passage. This is Hebrews 11, 32 through 35. What more can I say? Time is too short for me to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the raging fire, escaped the edge of the sword, gained strength and weakness, became mighty in battle, and put foreign armies to flight. Women received their dead, raised to life again. On Friday night, one of the last presenter at our African-American history celebration, she was a poet, and she would finish her reading and say, poem. And I feel like I should finish that and say, the word. There it is. This view of like these victories that are there. And I think it's kind of funny. Like you can imagine, David is like, that's all I get in this whole list. I mean, David just like, oh yeah, David, Samuel, Barak, Jephthah, right? And you're going, these are massive story arcs. The amount of beautiful worship and psalms that David gives us, and he just gets his name mentioned there. And then as it goes on, a couple of people don't even get their name mentioned, which I thought must have sort of hurt their feelings, right? Shut the mouths of lions. Daniel's like, I'm right here, Daniel. Why didn't you just say Daniel? Anyway, it's this fun little way of pouring out like so much more than what I can say here. I love at the very end of John, the Gospel of John, there's a little statement in there that's not written by John. It's written by his disciples. And they go, well, here, I'll just read it. It says, there are also many other things that Jesus did, which if every one of them were written down, I suppose not even the world itself could contain the books that would be written. And it's this kind of beautiful rhetorical phrase of going, I could go on and on and on. Meaning this isn't this like really limited, isolated list. It's like fill in the blanks and invites us to consider, does my name make the list? Would I live in such a way that this isn't some like limited, you know, really exclusive list of people? It's an invitation for all of us that this life lived by faith is a choice that all of us have. Some of the names that are mentioned, it's more than just Daniel, but it's these three friends of his, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? The fire is quenched, which isn't exactly accurate. The fire blazed. They just weren't burned. And they, to me, have this, they were like, as a kid, one of my favorite stories in Scripture. I loved, my very favorite is Joseph. But I think second to that was these three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they just get a short little chapter in Daniel, but it's a good one where you see this boldness, this courage that just stands in the midst of trial in this unwavering strength. They live and model to me kind of the essence of what faith is. And just as a bit of a recap, like, what is faith? We've learned already that faith is this assurance of what's hoped for. That in light of circumstances that appear otherwise, it's a sense of trust that something greater is happening, even when maybe it looks like those promises God has made are called into question. Or God says, I'll never leave you. Well, then what do you do when you're like, where are you, God? When God says, I will provide for you, I will protect you, and you're like, I don't feel so protected. Where is the provision? It's those gaps where faith is tested, where it matters, where we're able to do that sort of heroic step, holding our ground, responding in confidence. In Daniel, King Nebuchadnezzar is this Babylonian king who they've conquered the Israelites, they've laid siege, they wiped out the city, they took the very best of their young men and brought them in and kind of indoctrinated them into their culture. Daniel and his three friends, they become sort of proteges. They get included within the kind of educational system of this and they rise up with prominence. And then Nebuchadnezzar, in like all his might and grandeur, comes up with this brilliant idea to make himself a gold statue. This massive gold statue for everybody to look on and admire. A way of him trying to show that he, in some way, is like a god. Talking about transcendence, right? Flexing his power, displaying his glory. And then demanding that everybody kneels and bows to the statue. And in all of this, word gets out that these three guys refuse to bow. And so let me read Daniel 3. I'm going to read just some excerpts from it because otherwise it's quite long, a long chapter. So I'll just give you kind of the greatest hits here. But in Daniel 3, 1 to 2, it says, King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue, 90 feet high, 9 feet wide. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to assemble the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to attend the dedication of the statue King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Skipping ahead to verse 11, it says, whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. There are some Jews you have appointed to manage the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men have ignored you, the king. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold statue you've set up. Then in a furious rage, Nebuchadnezzar gave orders to bring in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar asked them, again, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is it true that you don't serve my gods or worship the gold statue I've set up? Now, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, drum, and every kind of music, fall down and worship the statue I made. But if you don't worship it, you will be immediately thrown into the furnace of blazing fire. And who is the God who can rescue you from my power? Right there is the question. They're going to end up turning this furnace really, really hot, like kind of overheating this thing. This question, who can stand up, right? This is the test that is placed. And this is what I think is interesting. And this is kind of the nuance that I want to get to today. Is these three guys don't say, just watch and see. Just watch and see what our God is going to do. They don't. It says this, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer to this question. If the God we serve exists, then he can rescue us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he can rescue us from the power of you, the king. But even if he does not rescue us, we want you as king to know that we will not serve your gods or worship the gold statue you set up. Like, do you see the difference? One is saying, like, I worship God because he does what I'm hoping that he does. That God is on my side and that in some ways I can sort of wield this power against you. The surrender, the posture of their hearts is like, despite the outcome, we trust. Despite the outcome, we hope. This is the kind of regarding that God could. And faith says, even if he doesn't hold to my agenda, I'm okay with that. In fact, the posture of faith surrenders my agenda. It isn't about me getting what I want. It's about God being God. This, to me, I think, allows for us to discover so much of the depth of what God is doing, how he is working in ways that far surpass what we think. The opportunity for us to learn even more about who God is. And I think this is why we have these tests. Is Nebuchadnezzar is demanding allegiance. And God, I don't think, is doing the same thing. I think God wants us to see who we are. And I think in these moments, what we see is this courage so profound that inspires us to ask that question, could I have responded the same? I was thinking this week, I had a conversation with a young friend of mine. She was talking about how she was looking for an apartment and has a boyfriend that's not a believer. And he was saying, if we get this apartment, maybe I'll consider Christianity. And they didn't get the apartment. They got a better one. And he came back and he's like, oh, wow, right? He like saw something different. And I was thinking, it's just such an interesting story of these questions of like, who is this God? Well, I imagine he's like this. So if he meets my agenda, then maybe I'll believe. And like God goes, I'm going to one-up you here. This way that God shows up, his own agenda. He's doing something so much more than what we can control. But that lack of control can be frightening to us. We have to hold on to truths. Have you ever thought, like, in a situation like this, like, what would I do? I think I probably would just bow. Right? Because what really is at risk? Just bow. No big deal. And then move on, right? Like on with the rest of your life. And something in them goes, absolutely not. This idea of worshiping this false power, of conforming to something else, it violates something core for them. We've talked about this idea that faith is like our ultimate concern, what matters the most to us. So to break that ultimate concern, it kind of shatters our integrity. And so often we're so afraid of just surviving this life, just making it through. We're constantly compromising and holding our cards tight. And this is a whole different way of being. It chooses right, even if you lose. God rescues them in this situation, and it's this beautiful picture of God's rescue. It says, since the king's command was so urgent and the furnace extremely hot, the raging flames killed those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The guys that were throwing them into the furnace, right? They fell down dead from the heat. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, bound into the furnace of blazing fire. Then King Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in alarm. He said to his advisors, didn't we throw three men bound into the fire? Yes, of course, your majesty, they replied to the king. He exclaimed, look, I see four men, not tied, walking around in the fire unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods. I don't think Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were expecting that. Right? People would call this a theophany, like God himself stands with them in the flames. And this shakes Nebuchadnezzar, and he gives praise to their God, but unfortunately, it's not quite enough. Nebuchadnezzar will eventually convert, but it's going to take a total humbling of him later. This story ends in victory, and I think we have every reason to celebrate the victories that occur. I think we need to, where we see God provide, where we see God overcome something that we thought was too great for us. Where we responded in total fear and then saw God's provision. I'm reminded of this in talking to a friend who doesn't have a place right now. They're potentially at risk of losing their home. And I was thinking, gosh, this one time where Patty and I, we were house sitting for a week and literally didn't know where we were going the week after that. And got a phone call and somebody said, hey, are you interested in? And I was like, oh, wow. Like at the last second, God provided, right? And I so want to turn that into a formula and go, just pray. This is what I prayed, and then this is what God did. So just do this. But you're like, no. This is a God who is free to do what he will. But it's relaxing into this faith, knowing that even if he doesn't act, there's something more, something better, something greater, something that transcends. I think of in Hebrews 11, it's going to go on and describe these people, well, what we've seen before, is they lived like this world wasn't their home. They lived as strangers here. And this sort of detachment is part of what it takes. The more we clutch to the things here and now, the more we become enslaved to those things. The more it compromises our decisions, we end up constantly trying to protect what we have instead of living in this space of courage. Hebrews 11:13 says, these all died in faith, although they had not received the things that were promised, but they saw them from a distance, greeted them, and confessed that they were foreigners and temporary residents on the earth. Now those who say such things make it clear they're seeking a homeland. If they were thinking about where they came from, they would have had an opportunity to return. But they now desire a better place, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By the way, just a shameless plug for this great divorce class that we're going to do a week from Wednesday. It is about imagining this homeland. It is about imagining what awaits. That we don't spend enough time probably thinking about that reality and making sure that our hearts are there. this way of thinking regarding this land is not our own, living in light of this greater reality. It allows us to stop investing our treasures here and to instead store them up for what is eternal. As Jesus says, don't store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust and thieves break in and steal. He probably could have included mold in there somewhere if he lived in Laguna, termites. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves don't break in and steal. And this last line, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And we see this again and again. That is what matters to God. Sometimes we think it's how we responded or all of our actions. And what it really comes down to for God is about our heart. That heart being set free. That heart able to respond in ways that are glorious, heroic. I read this week. It said, historically, to have courage meant to have a strong heart. Not just bravery in battle, but inner strength to face challenges, suffering, or fear. When your treasures are in heaven, then the loss of anything down here, there's a resilience that you have to it. Thomas Aquinas called courage, he said, courage is a virtue that enables people to stand firm in the face of difficulties, which comes from the heart's strength. We talked about last week how the challenges, the tests, it's creating in us endurance. It's making our hearts strong. That these things, exercising our hearts in this way, allows our hearts to grow. And when we stand firm in this place, it allows us to stand in our integrity. It allows us to experience glory. But there's a whole nother level to this than that. I think of in verse 6 of Hebrews 11, it says, without faith, it's impossible to please God, since the one who draws near to him must believe he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. This idea of pleasing God, it probably is better translated as like delighting God. There's something about that heart standing in that place of vulnerability that brings God delight. And like I think about this, and you've heard me say this too many times, but I just think, you know, being a parent allows you to get a little glimpse of what it's like to be God. And I think of my kids in that place of vulnerability. I always use this example, but I think of like little Gabe. One time he had to give blood when he was young, and he was sitting on my lap shaking so hard, but like didn't flinch. Like they drew like vials of blood out of my son because something we were worried about at the time. But I just remember holding him as he shook and thinking, I'm so proud of him, the courage in that vulnerable space. I was thinking this with my daughter the other day. We enjoy rock climbing together, and I saw her fall on this climb that she's made a million times. But her heart was troubled, but I could see from her shoulders that there were tears in her eyes. Just from here, right, I can see it. I just know her so well. That vulnerable heart. When I see that in my kids, I'm like moved with such like affection for them. When they do hard things, when they live in that vulnerable space. And I think this is what happens with God when he sees us stand in these places, that his heart is so moved. This idea of stepping into this reality, of living a life that is pleasing to God, this is part of the glory that we're invited to. And we experience temporary pain and suffering and difficulties, and some of it just feels so overwhelming at the time. There's a few situations that I'm holding right now for others that I think, oh my goodness, they're overwhelming. But it's this reminder that God says, I see them, I know them, all this will be made well. that we can live our life with that reassurance that things will be restored. That we don't have to play with scared money. Have you heard that expression before? And I like this expression that so often we're going through and we're like just playing our cards with the little resources that we have, right? And we're so like intimidated to overplay our hand. And what if it was all secure? Ultimately, what if nothing was at risk? How would we play? What would you do in your life if you knew that nothing ultimately was at risk? Because this is where our chapter ends. Not just with the victories, but with the losses. And it's somewhat startling. He's talking about these women who have had their sons brought back to life. But then he shifts. In the second half of 35, he says, other people were tortured, not accepting release so that they might gain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings as well as bonds and imprisonments. They were stoned, Jeremiah. They were sawed in two, Isaiah. They died afflicted and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and on mountains, hiding in caves and holes in the ground. All these were approved through their faith, but they did not receive what was promised, since God had provided them something better for us, so they would not be made perfect without us. What is he talking about there? Well, he's about to go into this. What Jesus provides, the context, the perspective that Jesus provides. This phrase, it says other people here, but probably a better translation is just simply the word others. And it's probably a reference, as it's talking about these women who had their children restored, that there were others that did not. F.F. Bruce and some others have said this might be a reference to this story that occurs in the book of Maccabees. And in this story, there was a mother who had seven sons. And this is during the time where the Greeks had taken over Israel. I mean, it's just one thing after the next, right? Daniel pictures these monsters coming out and devouring each other. But like one after the next, Greece comes. And Antiochus Epiphanes is this king who's just barbaric and is like wants to suppress the people by getting them to recant their faith, defiles their temples, all of this. But and this is, you know, this is a little bit heavy, but basically says if to this woman, if your sons don't recant their faith, I'm going to dismember them, cut their tongues out, right? And so like one at a time, he starts doing this in front of this mom. And this, like, the third son comes out and he just holds his arms out. He says, it was from heaven that I received these. For the sake of his laws, I disregard them. From him, I hope to receive them again. It was from heaven that I received these. For the sake of his laws, I disregard them. From him, I hope to receive them again. And this is like the history right preceding Christ. But I love how it says in here, like, what would give you the courage? Well, a better resurrection. And this is, to me, what's so profound as we go into kind of the Lenten season, as we anticipate Easter, as we anticipate what all that means, we're focusing on this better resurrection. Some would say everybody raised to life, including Lazarus by Jesus, weren't resurrected. They were resuscitated. They were brought back to life, right? It's kind of like, you know, if you come in and perform CPR or you know, some way of bringing the heart back, getting air back in the lungs, people that are technically dead brought back to life. And there's something miraculous about these moments in Scripture where that occurs. But the better resurrection is not life after death. The better resurrection is life after death. Brought back into this place of full restoration. And that this is what Jesus models. Not only does he come and suffer and die and experience the very worst pain that was being put on the people of Israel, that's where Jesus ended up, and demonstrates that this hope that these young men had was true. that death is not the end. And that on the other side is everything being renewed and made right. That's the anchor for our souls that Hebrews talks about. And it requires us, I think, in all of this, and we keep talking about this, but to come to terms with our own mortality. That all of us only have so many days, so many breaths, so much time here. That at some point all of us cross that line. How have we lived our life? What are we investing in? And this heroic courage is just simply saying, that's where my hope lies. But it's not this blind sort of belief that we, unlike them, can look to Christ. Look to the reality of that. And we'll talk about this more and more. The reasons why the resurrection is so compelling. I won't go into it now, except to say one of my favorite stories is when C.S. Lewis was still an atheist, there was this historian that was sort of dumbfounded by the resurrection. And he's like, you know, despite what I want to believe, it really looks like this one time, this dying God thing really happened. This truth that like stands out there. That calls all of us to a response. To see through our death to the hope that we have. And this might temporarily cause suffering. I think that this is what Paul meant when he referred to himself in this posture of becoming like a fool for Christ. That the world would look at this and think, this is too great of a risk. But Paul says, I think God has displayed us, the apostles, in last place, like men condemned to die. We've become a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to people. We are fools for Christ, but you are wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong. You are distinguished, but we are dishonored. And this sort of willingness to just stand in that place, so vulnerable. And when I think about it, these are the stories that capture my heart. I think about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and somebody who was studying in America to be a pastor, but he was German. And as he saw what was happening in Germany during World War II, he couldn't help but go home, to leave that place of safety, to move towards the suffering. And this sort of act of heroism actually cost him his life. It was like tragically 2 weeks before the end of the war and he was hanged in like a final act of vindictiveness. But during that time, he fostered this beautiful little community, almost like a seminary that took place in prison. He wrote this book, Life Together, and it's about this intimacy that they found even in the midst of their chains, this freedom and this power that occurred there. I think for all of us, whatever that is, we have this opportunity to step in, even with the little trials and challenges where we don't understand what God is doing, but we endure and persevere. We trust and we hope. And it gives us a reality not just to despair, to fight against despair, but to actually move forward in courage. Because there's work to be done. There's light that speaks to the darkness, that casts it out. And these small little acts of courage, I think of praying with Rebecca before her event on Friday. And little Rebecca, like wondering, is anybody going to come? And they ended up having to turn people away. There just wasn't space in that room. So brave. Just love it. All of these opportunities for us to shine light. And the reality is that when God sees that, his heart is moved. When we behave in such a way, he's like, oh, that's my girl. That's my boy. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, I've come to the conclusion that I made a mistake in coming to America. I must live through this difficult period in our national history with the people of Germany. I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. This was our example of what Moses did, who left aside the pleasures of Egypt to stand with his people in their displacement. May we as a church have the courage to step in where we see suffering, where we see people pushed to the side, where we see people in despair, to step forward and provide that strength to be with them, not from afar, but to join them in the midst of that. We go to the Lord's table and we remember that this is what God does, that God gives us this example himself, coming to earth in humility, emptying himself of power, enduring the cross, and then proclaiming the hope that all things shall be made new. Before we go to the Lord's table, let me just read a couple questions for us for reflection. Question one, who inspires you? What are the stories that move you? What about those stories speaks into your own story? Those stories that capture our hearts, that's telling us something about the way that we're made. Number two, is there a choice in your life that feels too risky? What is the fear that's holding you back? What is the potential cost that feels too great? To stand in that place and choose the things of eternal value. Last, what if nothing is ultimately at risk? How would you respond if you knew the ultimate outcome was secure? How does the resurrection of Jesus provide a perspective of hope to your current situation?